This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for starting your week with Talk Louisiana.
We start with a huge name in the world of show business, a fabulous singer who's still going strong after all these years and has written her memoirs. Toni Tenniel is with us, the pride of Montgomery, Alabama. She and her former husband, Daryl Dragon, were the captain in Tenniel, and in the 1970s, nobody did it better than they did, and they began with their signature song, Love Will Keep Us Together. Now, Toni, you were raised in Montgomery, Alabama, so you know a little bit about Louisiana and the South, and you still live in the South. How are things going?
Well, I just moved back to the South after almost 50 years of living in the West. I was living in California, Nevada, and finally, for the last 8 years, Arizona. But I moved back here in August to live near my sister Jane and her husband. Jane is closest in age to me. And my co-author and niece, Caroline Tenniel St. Clair, who is Jane's youngest daughter. And also I have a lot of other East Coast family, so it's terrific to be back where the Spanish moss hangs off the oak trees. it's really nice.
There you go. Now, what caused you to write about your life? It took a while, but you decided to do it, and you've done it in a big way.
Well, you know, it's hard to explain. It took Caroline and me 2 years to write the book because I wanted to make sure I expressed myself exactly the way I wanted to about what happened. Whenever you're a so-called celebrity, you know, people will often say, when you're as old as I am, when are you going to write your memoirs? And I always said I wasn't, and I meant it. One of the main reasons that I wasn't going to do it is that I wasn't sure what I was going to do about my marriage to Daryl. And if anybody reads the memoir, then they will understand that musically it was perfect, but personally it was extremely difficult. And so once I had made up my mind, I lived in Prescott, Arizona for 8 years, and I spent most of that time trying to decide what I was going to do, and then with the help of dear friends and great family and a good therapist in Prescott, I finally made the decision to divorce Daryl. And so once I had made that decision, the thing that made me wait so long was I was so worried about what our fans would think that had loved us as the, quote, perfect couple, unquote, all these years. And knowing how some of them are, I was afraid they would be really devastated, not understanding. So I asked my niece Caroline, who's a fine writer, if she would write it with me so I could kind of lay out what it took for me to come to this decision and why I made the decision so they would kind of understand. And the wonderful thing is that I would say 90% of the response I've gotten to the book has been absolutely positive and wonderful.
You and Daryl were together a very long time. And,
yes, we were.
And, of course, you had that magic on the big screen, the small screen, wherever you were when you were performing. But
right.
You indicate that it was not a complete relationship. Why not?
Well, you know, it's very hard to explain it because I wanted to make sure I did a lot of nuance and subtlety so people would understand what I was talking about. None of this, I will preface it by saying, was Daryl's fault at all. It was all mine because I was raised in a very, very loving and supportive family. We all love each other and take care of each other, and that's just the way I was raised. Daryl was raised completely differently. His father was a very, very famous symphony conductor, Academy Award-winning film scorer. He founded the Hollywood Bowl Symphony Orchestra, conducted all over the world. But he was very, very tough on his kids, particularly the three boys. He was critical all the time, and I won't go into detail, but there was some abuse also. And that family, as I met them, once I had met Daryl and he took me to meet them, there was no affection among them that I could evidence, that I could see. His mother had suffered for years from clinical depression, and so she really could not be there for Daryl to support him, although she loved him unconditionally. But the whole family was affected by this relationship with their father and their mother. So I thought, I had so much love, and I was raised with so much love, I thought, you know, it may take me some time, but I think I can take this brilliant man and show him what it's like to express the joy you feel in making music, the wonderful love that can come from all of that. And I was patient. I'm a Taurus. We're stubborn and we're loyal. Mm-hmm. And I was patient, and went through it for years. But the fact of the matter is Daryl was unable to express any emotional affection. He just couldn't do it. And the whole time we were together, he never said, I love you. He just could not do it. And the funny thing was, I was, you know, writing all these songs for him, expressing how I felt about him, because I wasn't going to tell him. He knew, but I was never going to tell him out loud unless he told me. But I wrote The Way I Want to Touch You, which was the first song I wrote for him, and Do That to Me One More Time I wrote for him, and many, many others. And I found out many years later, he told me that he never paid any attention to lyrics. He only cared about the music. And so all that, you know, time I spent writing these perfect words that would express how I felt, he never watched them or paid any attention to them.
How did he respond to the breakup?
You know, it's interesting because it's evolved. We had a very easy divorce. We have no children. We've always been straight ahead with each other. We just split everything down the middle. It was easy to do. We still own a business together. Our publishing company we still own together. And then I lived in Prescott, where he is right now, for quite a while before my sister Jane called me and said, we want you to move here to Florida and be near us. And I thought, you know, there's nothing, no reason I have to stay where I am. But what I'm finding now is that Daryl is beginning to take control of his own life. It's kind of like I was enabling him to continue with his type of behavior, and it's hard to explain. I have to say, I don't want to tell people they have to buy the book to understand, but they really do, to read it. Or you can check it out at your library and read it. He and I still talk. We're friends. We talk at least once every week, 10 days. I just talked to him yesterday.
Catherine Antoinette Tenniel, the pride of Montgomery, Alabama, is about to celebrate a birthday. She's been with us on the world scene for a very long time. I remember 1972, and Love Will Keep Us Together.
75.
Okay. The year you and the captain were married, right?
Well, yeah. Yes. Yes. According, are you talking about the Valentine's Day thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was not true. That was a publicity thing that our record company put out because we were living together, and they were so worried that people would know that we weren't really married. We were actually married on Veterans Day, November 11th.
1975. That was a Tuesday, and one that I'm sure you remember with fondness, and you and the captain were together for a very long time, and you've written about that life and the breakup in Tony Tenniel. But that song was it was a remarkable song, and if I remember right, isn't the last line Sadaka is back?
Yes, that's exactly right, and that was something that I just threw in there when we were recording the last little da 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 things on the end as it faded out. If you got a minute, I'll tell you how that came about.
Certainly.
Okay. Well, we had finished our first album for A&M pretty much, but we felt we needed one more song, an up-tempo song. So the head of A&R there at A&M Records suggested that we listen to an album that Neil Sedaka had released only in the United Kingdom, in England and Scotland and so forth. And so we went into his office and we listened and we liked the songs we heard, but then we heard Love Will Keep Us Together, and that stopped. That was it. We knew that was the song we'd been looking for. And the album that Neil had released was called Sedaka's Back. So we went into the studio the next day to start making the recording, and within 3 days we had finished it. And when we heard the play, when we were doing the playback, or when we were recording, I'm sorry, the final background vocals, I just thought, you know, what a great tune that Neil and Howie Greenfield wrote. And I just said, Sedaka is back, meaning he's back writing great songs again. Mm-hmm. And we were going to take it out. It was just something that slipped out. And then when we heard it on the playback, we thought, let's keep it in because it's a tribute to one of the great pop songwriters.
Muskrat, muskrat, candlelights.
Thank you for starting your week with Talk Louisiana, and we continue with one of the great luminaries of the music world, Tony Tennille.
Well, one of the songs you mentioned earlier that you wrote for the captain, Daryl Dragon, and he didn't really appreciate it, at least not the way you had hoped, is one of the favorites from that era. Let's give it a listen, Emily.
Okay.
Let's go. Now, how could he not appreciate that song, Tony Tennille?
I don't know, because he didn't.
He just didn't, but...
He just didn't. He wasn't a lyric man. You know, when he wrote songs, he wrote instrumentals. That was his, you know, thing. And he did a great job of it, but I was the one who wrote the songs that people could actually sing words to.
And you were a striking presence. You really looked good together, and I'm sure that was part of the appeal in addition to your spectacular voice.
Well, Daryl never, ever wanted to be up front. When he worked in clubs with his brothers for years in Malibu area and all around in there, Daryl was always in the background because that's what he preferred. His brother Doug sang lead. And when he worked with the Beach Boys for years, he was one of their backup musicians. He was never in the front. So when he met me and we started working together, he knew that I could be the one who talked to the audience. And he could, you know, just be doing his fun things that he did on the keyboards and his great playing. And I would be the communicator for the two of us.
We're spending a few more minutes with the fabulous Tony Tennille. She's had a long and spectacular career as a singer and still has a melodious voice that we've heard for the last several minutes. The pride of Montgomery, Alabama. Went to Auburn University, by the way.
I did.
And I'm sure some people in this part of the world would find that interesting. You actually... You took classical piano at Auburn, didn't you?
No, I studied classical piano starting when I was 7 years old and studied for 10 years. And then when I went to Auburn, I switched over from a music major to a music minor and an English major. And that's what I was studying when I was there.
And your father, did he sing with it wasn't Bing Crosby, but Bob Crosby, who was
a big
singer.
Bob Crosby and his Bobcats.
Bob
and the Bobcats, and then Daddy also was the very first vocalist of the Auburn Knights Orchestra, which is still in existence today, and I was the first child of an original vocalist to sing with the band. So I sang with the band, helped pay my way through college while I was there.
And a listener wants to know if you sang back up on Pink Floyd's The Wall. Is that right?
I certainly did, and that was my claim to hipness.
Well, you also.
I'm pretty cool.
Yeah,
see?
Well, that's about as cool as it gets. That's one of the classics of all time, in addition to your own work that is substantial. But did you also do some backup work for Elton John?
Yes, for Elton John. Actually, there were Carl Wilson of the Wilson brothers, you know, Brian, Carl, and mm-hmm. Dennis. Carl Wilson and Bruce Johnston from the Beach Boys and I and a studio singer named John Joyce, when we were in town and some of our colleagues would need background vocals, we'd go in and do them for them. And so consequently, we ended up doing Pink Floyd. We ended up doing Elton. I can hear my voice in Elton's Don't Go, Let the Sun Go Down on Me. So you can listen to that and see if you can hear
it. Okay, well, I'm going to do that right after the show.
Okay, well, you're not supposed to hear that, you know, an individual voice in backgrounds, but somehow it leaked out a little that time.
Oh, well.
And also Art Garfunkel, we did some work for him, too.
Well, and talk about a magnificent vocalist. Art Garfunkel was rather good. Now, how did you meet the Captain?
Well, I met him because of a musical I had written back in 1969 called Mother Earth. It was an ecology musical, and it became a professional production up in San Francisco. And we were going to move it down to L.A., but we needed a keyboard player, new one. And Daryl was off the road with the Beach Boys. They were taking a break. And after hearing a recording of me with the songs I had written for the show and my voice, he flew up to San Francisco to audition for me. And I hired him. And then the next thing I knew, he hired me, or recommended me to Carl Wilson, to play acoustic piano for the Beach Boys for a year while their regular piano player quit to get his degree. So we hired each other. That's
wow.
How we started.
It's a great story. Now, you always appeared to be tall, statuesque, beautiful, long legs. How tall are you?
Well, I was 5'11", but now at 75, almost 1 year older, I think I've shrunk a little bit. That kind of happens, but I'm still tall. But the thing is, I used to wear those 3- and 4-inch heels all the time when I was doing my thing mm-hmm. on the stage or whatever, and I can't wear them anymore. Those heels killed my feet, so I'm just wandering around in flats and sneakers these days.
Well, I am very impressed that you gave your age, and
can't hide it.
Quite often, people, especially ladies, they don't like to reveal their age, and men will lie more about their height than anything else.
That's funny. Well, my mother always lied about her age, and she said, "Tony, you're going to have to start lying about your age because it doesn't make sense. I'm still so young, and you're getting older."
Well, before you leave, let's give a listen to another classic from The Captain and Tennille. Here's another one that I think all of our audience will remember with great fondness.
I knew it was going to be that.
Muskrat, muskrat, candlelight, doing the town and doing it right in the evening. It's pretty pleasing. Muskrat Susie, muskrat Sam, do the jitterbug at it. Muskrat land and he shim.
You were quite a team.
Yes, we were. Okay. Yes, we are. And we were, and we still, you know, he'll always be a part of me, always. And I know I am always a part of him.
Does it hearten you to know that your music will, it'll outlive everybody who's listening to this show? Certainly it'll outlive the people on the show right now. People will be listening to these songs 30, 40, 50 years from now.
Well, you know, actually, that's very humbling, and that's something I've realized now since Caroline and I have been out promoting the memoir. We are a part of people's memories forever, and that means a lot. That means a lot.
Well, the book is Tony Tennille from the remarkable Tony Tennille, who's had quite a life and is sharing it with the masses, and we commend you for doing so.
And Jim, also, I want to make sure that people know it's available in audio. I read it. I read the audio book, so I narrated it. So if you'd like to hear my voice telling the story, you can get that at Audible Audio.
Audible Audio from Tony Tenniel. Thank you, Tony.
Thank you so much for having me on.
It's been a pleasure.
Coming next, Brian Kilmeade from Fox & Friends with a compelling biography about Andrew Jackson, and Nicholas Jennings later with his book about Gordon Lightfoot.
If you could read my mind, love, what a tale my thoughts could tell. Just like an old-time movie about a ghost from a wishing well. In a castle dark or a fortress strong, with chains upon my feet, you know that ghost is me. And I will never be set free as long as I'm a ghost you can't see. If I could read your mind, love, what a tale your thoughts could tell.
This is Jim Inkster, and we're pleased to have as our guest at this time Brian Kilmeade of Fox and Friends. He's a best-selling author, and his book, his latest one, is in the top 10, has been in the top 5, the historical thriller Andrew Jackson and the Miracle of New Orleans, the battle that shaped America's destiny, offers new understanding to one of America's greatest generals who later became one of its most controversial presidents. And before we get into the intricacies of the book, Brian, what about the seventh American president? What was captivating enough about Old Hickory for you to decide to write a book about him?
I mean, there's so much. By the way, I had a chance to go to New Orleans. We're doing a special on Andrew Jackson. Walk the battlefield with Douglas Brinkley and Ron Drez, very respected former Marine and very respected historian in the area. To me, there's everything impressive. I mean, I love these times in American history that I don't think get enough attention. And Andrew Jackson in particular, if you said an American at 13 with no parents, an orphan, you're going to have a tough time today. Can you imagine when we couldn't even forge to the Midwest? We thought that was the West. Can you imagine when there were very few roads? Certainly wasn't any social safety net of welfare and Social Security. But this orphan never got a present his entire youth, watched his brothers die during the war and his mom pass away before it concluded. All he had was a sense of, well, I got to get revenge on the British, and my country's got to rally and help raise me, and they did. So he bled red, white, and blue. So when I could focus on one area, and that was Jackson's military record, I thought this would be a great opportunity. Also, I'm always looking for any opportunity to get to Louisiana.
Well, by mid-1814, President James Madison's generals had lost control of the War of 1812 in the North, losing battles in Canada, and British troops set the White House ablaze, and it didn't look good for the United States, but in this dire situation stepped Major General Andrew Jackson. What enabled him to overcome all odds?
Well, if you ask him, it had a lot to do with the Ursuline nuns located right there in New Orleans in that convent. They said, if you guys keep in control, would you sustain us? And he said, absolutely. Jefferson promised, and Jackson fulfilled that, followed up on that. So he goes, good, we'll pray for your victory. He actually thought it was divine intervention. Also, some cunning strategy. They built a berm. They redug a canal. The city rallied with shovels. They dug that canal. They filled it with water. So the British landed at the perfect spot in order to be boxed in. And their commanding general, who arrived at the scene late, knew it. They said, "You had to get out of here." The generals had deployed said, "Wait a second. We're the British. We don't back out. These guys can't stop us. Mm-hmm. A bunch of ranchers. Forget it." And not only did they stop them, the British had only one way to fight: march straight ahead. And they were basically just torn up by Jackson's men in under 45 minutes. So it was a combination of bad placement by the British, great idea by Jackson, great implementation by the people of New Orleans, and a coming together force of free blacks, Choctaw and Cherokee Indians, pirates, riflemen from Kentucky and Tennessee, as well as regular militia that combined to about 5,000 tops to take out 10,000 British troops.
And Jackson was not a particularly young man at the time. He was in his late 40s. He had already had a full life. Did his background, was it a catalyst as far as the success that he had in the War of 1812?
Revenge. Revenge is great. It's a great motivation. They killed my family. I'm going to kill you. You know, it worked with William Wallace and Mel Gibson in Braveheart.
Uh-huh.
You know, it worked in Gladiator, and it worked for Jackson. The only problem is, you know, those other two stories were embellished. I stuck to the script here of what really happened, and I just could not believe the story. The more I researched, the more in awe I am. To see them execute, to know that he was just went by instinct without any formal military training, with this great leadership ability while suffering from dysentery, still become the leader of men. After this whole war was basically a series of defeats, so he believed what Americans always believe, that we have a shot at winning, that we're different, we're better, or exceptional. We will melt away if we have to and fight another day. And I thought it was very interesting that that Wellington, the most famous commander in the military at that time, sent his men, but he wouldn't go. They said, hey, why don't you go over there? We'll give you New Orleans. We'll give you Louisiana. He said, no, I don't promise myself much success there. And they thought, really? The colonies? Without any standing army? Barely a navy? What do you mean you don't promise yourself much success there? He was 100% right. He sent his brother-in-law, and his brother-in-law was killed right away, one of two commanding generals to die, seven colonels and over 70 officers. So we aimed for the officers. We didn't aim for the infantry. And that was another thing pretty unique.
The book is Andrew Jackson and the Miracle of New Orleans, the battle that shaped America's destiny, from Brian Kilmeade. And when this battle took place, Andrew Jackson was a seasoned veteran of skirmishes, had been wounded a couple of times, but he was not deterred, was he?
Never. I mean, when he had problems, he was told by his mom, one of her last thing was, you know, don't look for someone else to litigate it. You take care of it, even though he was a lawyer. And he would, you know, the way they did it back then, you know, they shot you. They had duels. And a lot of time he was the second and would end up as the first. And he had some bullets. He should have died. There was a bullet lodged by his lung that gave him problems the rest of his life. You know, when the whole Horseshoe Bend or the Creek War started, that his guys were asked to settle for Madison and Monroe. You know, he was so banged up, he didn't think he could go, but he rallied his guys together, and they did, and he got better and better and better. But still, by the time, you know, he was suffering from an infection by the time that they got to New Orleans, but didn't let him bother him. Guy was 6'1", down to 135 pounds at 40 something years old back then, without cutting edge medicine. So he survived up until his 80s, which is just amazing.
It is an amazing man, and he was elected president in 1828. Would he have been able to win the support of the American people without the tremendous success in New Orleans?
No way. I love that question, because it's just, it's not a gray area. He left famous locally and respected locally. He came back to the Hermitage, the most famous man in America. In a war in which he had very few things to hang our hat on, he comes back after the Treaty of Ghent is signed with a tremendous victory that no one predicted, few understood. But when the details came out, it was such an uneven victory for us that Americans love to make someone, elevate someone a hero. And Jackson was more than happy to take that elevation. So he was he had a swag about him, much like our current president, distrusted the press, much like our current president. You know, he overcame the odds by going to the people. That's how he became president, much like this one. Despised by the Washington establishment, much like this one. Willing to criticize his predecessors, much like our current president. And find a way to be successful, much like this, while still creating a lot of enemies. You know, Jackson even today has enemies.
Yeah, but in those days, Brian, men didn't tweet. They dueled. And Jackson was a seasoned dueler. He killed at least one man in a duel, and of course he could have been killed himself, and we're talking about multiple duels. This is not the kind of thing that most people do if they want to live a long life.
No, he isn't, but he was willing to die. He saw a lot of death and destruction. He witnessed the Revolutionary War. He saw how he was taken prisoner at 13 years old. You know, he saw bodies all around him and saw how brutal the British could be. So he was not afraid to die, and that was one thing. He, you know, when you have this confidence about you, and you every day is survival. He literally would go from house to house, and he was such a handful as a kid. You know, the relatives weren't really embracing him, so neighbors would take him in. So he knows that life, you know, no one promised you tomorrow was something that he certainly subscribed to on a daily basis. And that's what you got to do. If you're going to lead men back in those days, you have to show that you'll lead in front, not in back, a lot. Washington knew it, and so did Jackson. Jackson point blank should have been killed multiple times. He did, wasn't. And the same thing they say about Washington. There was something about these men that, you know, that was destined for greater things.
Did the fact that he owned slaves, does that detract from his legacy?
Sure, but, you know, we can never factor in our beliefs today of people that lived 200 years ago. Just like if you went up to Barack Obama in 2008 and said, hey, is marriage between a man and a woman? He would say absolutely. And in 2012, he ran on same-sex marriage. So was he a terrible person in 08 and a wonderful person in 2012? Or is he a person in his time when things were just changing? All those people people who sat on buses in the 60s in the Deep South and watched as blacks walked to the back, were they horrible people? When there were any fans, white fans that went to white-only baseball, were they horrible people? And then, while the Negro Leagues had their own second-class situation, no. But they were people of their time. 80% of the people in the South were landowners and slave owners. Was he a great slave owner? Do you want to get into that? I don't think that's worthy of a conversation. But I do think that you can judge someone and put him on a statue without being perfect, but you could talk about what they accomplished. And, the Trail of Tears isn't great, but every president in that time had to deal with Indian removal. That was a major issue back then. North Korea is a major issue for our generation. Will it be in 50 years? Probably not. I think we'll take care of it by then. Does that mean we handled it wrong up until now? Well, maybe, depending on how this ends.
Well, Jackson appeared to fight every chance he got, and of course, he is a legitimate American hero, as we see with the statues in Jackson Square and at the White House, by the way, essentially the same statue. But recent times, we've had presidents born in the summer of 46, Clinton, Bush, and Trump, and they did everything they could to stay out of the war of their generation. Is it unfortunate that we don't have more men like Andrew Jackson today and instead, for all intents, have had elected three draft dodgers as president of the United States?
Well, I mean, we have great generals. And, you have generals right now surrounding this president. You had some good leaders, General Jones, who was exited from the last administration. General Dunford's a tremendous Joint Chiefs of Staff leader. So you have civilian presidents. That was always the intention. You have a controversial war in Vietnam, and where President Obama wasn't really a draft dodger. You had President Clinton certainly was.
Clinton, Bush, and Trump.
Well, Bush was in the National Guard.
But he was in the National Guard in lieu of fighting in the war. That was an arranged assignment.
Well, let's let Dan Rather litigate that. It cost him his career.
I don't think there's any doubt. No, it wasn't about whether he had done the right thing, or it was about whether the documents that Dan Rather used when Bush went to AWOL in Alabama, whether those were legitimate. It had nothing to do with whether George Bush was trying to avoid Vietnam. I think we know he was, Brian.
I think we know he signed up for the National Guard. I mean, if you ask him if he's trying to avoid Vietnam, I'll let him answer. But in terms of this president in the 1960s, I would think that as a comparison, I wouldn't even necessarily make.
Well, he likes to compare himself to Andrew Jackson, and Donald Trump got out on bone spurs. I don't think Andrew Jackson ever complained about bone spurs.
Well, that would be true, too, and no one really, Andrew Jackson was someone born with meager means, and, Donald Trump famously was gotten $1 million, but he made it $1 billion. But he also had a ton of similarities, ton of enemies. The establishment that despised him, wanted him to fail, never thought he deserved it. The predecessor in John Quincy Adams that didn't even wait in the White House or go to the inauguration because he didn't like he was being treated by Jackson when he was elected. You have President Obama, who clearly, even though they had some moments of civility, but they truly didn't respect each other. Well, all President Obama did was attack President Trump personally and at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and Trump came right back, much like Quincy Adams and much like Jackson.
Well, the book is Andrew Jackson and the Miracle of New Orleans, the battle that shaped America's destiny. It's been a pleasure, and congratulations on an amazing bestseller from Brian Kilmeade with Don Yeager. It's been quite an early reception for your book, and I appreciate you joining us today. It's been a pleasure. This is Jim Inkster, and we're joined by Nicholas Jennings, one of Canada's most respected music journalists. He was the critic and feature writer for Maclean's from 1980 to 2000. His work has appeared in many of Canada's top magazines and newspapers, and his latest work is Lightfoot, and it is about Gordon Lightfoot, one of the most remarkable singers of his time or any time. His name is synonymous with timeless songs about trains and shipwrecks, rivers and highways, lovers and loneliness. His music defined the folk pop sound of the 60s and 70s, and he is a fascinating man both with his music and his life. And it is an honor to share the microphone with you, Nicholas Jennings.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, Gordon Lightfoot is a gentleman who's had a long, long career, and he certainly has had some twists and turns along the way, both in his private life and in his professional life. But you've captured him. He is a fascinating gentleman to this day, isn't he?
Well, he is, Jim, and it's a testament to who he is that not only has he created this huge body of work, songs that, will outlive all of us, that are known all over the world, but also that he's done this, through a life where he's battled challenges. I mean, modesty, shyness, alcoholism, he's had six children by four different women, and he's come through the other end to be a good father, and just basically has made good on the wrongs of his past. So it's sort of a fascinating journey for me to have charted, because I got to learn something about the man behind the songs that wasn't previously known, because he's always been very kind of guarded about his private life. And this was the first time he's ever opened up to a writer at this length.
How did you get this kind of access to Gordon Lightfoot?
Well, I think it was developed. There was a trust that was developed between him and I over time. I interviewed him on a number of occasions, and I think he realized, Jim, that I wasn't the kind of writer that was looking to dig dirt for the sake of sensationalism or sales. You know, I wasn't going to gloss over the darker episodes, but I was looking really to try and understand the man behind the music. And so I tried to really create a balanced account. And I think he realized that's the kind of writer I was, and that's why he consented for me to do his biography.
How much of his travails personally have affected his work, perhaps in a positive way? Certainly his writing is emblematic of somebody who's lived a full life.
Well, I think Gordon Lightfoot has one of his real strengths as a songwriter is that he's always been very open and honest about himself and his feelings. And this is coming from a man who isn't that forthcoming in person. I mean, I actually find it fascinating that he's far more articulate in his writing and his songs than he is in person. You know, he's able to capture very deep and sometimes profound feelings of the human condition based on his own experiences, and then he reflects them in these songs that immediately connect with people. And I've been to a lot of Gordon Lightfoot concerts, both in the United States and up here in Canada. What his fans, the hardcore fans, tell me is that, you know, that his songs speak to them. And, you know, I think that's the mark of a great songwriter, someone who can channel personal songs, personal experiences, and make them universal. And I think Gordon Lightfoot's mm-hmm. done that remarkably well. I mean, songs like, If You Could Read My Mind, or Sundown, or Early Morning Rain. I mean, these are songs that, you know, that reveal a lot to us about, I mean, we can relate to songs that deal with heartbreak or loneliness or jealousy, in the case of those three songs.
Well, Sundown, who was he writing about?
That was a song that came out of a very passionate affair he had after his first marriage broke up, and it was with a woman named Kathy Smith. It was, a very passionate relationship, but there was a lot of jealousy between the two of them, and I think that was fueled somewhat by alcohol, because Gordon Lightfoot was certainly a heavy drinker through the 70s, and I think that jealousy, sort of the passion, but the jealousy that was at the core of that relationship came out in the song Sundown.
And Kathy Smith, of course, became infamous for having spent the last night of John Belushi's life with him.
Yeah, so you know, she went on, after she and Gordon Lightfoot broke up, she went on to have a quite a wild ride, I suppose you would say, involving drugs and other celebrities. And she sort of ended up on a kind of a notorious note, given that she was with John Belushi when he died of an overdose.
The song,
the remarkable thing, Jim, about Gordon Lightfoot is, and this is one of the values that I think it's a hallmark of him, is that he's a very loyal man. So it would have been very easy for Gordon Lightfoot to abandon Kathy Smith when they broke up and, you know, she started getting into trouble. But to his credit, he continued to make himself available in terms of emotional support. And I think he also helped her out financially, just because, you know, this was a woman he once loved, and he realized that, you know, she needed a helping hand. So he didn't abandon her, which is, I think, pretty remarkable.
Well, the song Beautiful is one that is a different type of song, and it has to be about somebody.
Yeah, and that's about his first wife, Britta. And I think, Gordon Lightfoot has written some of the most absolutely enduring love songs, and they're certainly Beautiful is one that he plays in every single concert. He did so earlier this year when he did his American and Canadian tour of some 70 dates, and it's one of his standards. People always look forward to hearing Beautiful.
His music has been covered by so many artists, and we're talking about people like Barbara Streisand and Elvis Presley, Bob Dylan. Mm-hmm. The luminaries of the industry, Joni Mitchell, the people who are in the industry certainly respect his talent immensely.
Yeah, I mean, I think Gordon Lightfoot came up during the folk boom in the 60s. He shared a manager with Bob Dylan. So right from the get-go, Gordon Lightfoot and Bob Dylan were kind of like in the same stable, as it were, and they became admirers of each other's work. So no one could keep up with Bob Dylan. He was the most prolific songwriter of all time, and yet Gordon Lightfoot did his best and was pretty prolific in his own right. And Bob Dylan has always pointed to Gordon Lightfoot as being one of his favorite songwriters. So too did Johnny Cash and Neil Young and other people like that. So he's, and his songs, as you say, Jim, have been recorded by countless artists all over the world. He's one of the most covered songwriters of all time.
Well, the book is Lightfoot from Nicholas Jennings, and it has some amazing photographs as well. I'm looking at the one from 1966 at John F. Kennedy Airport.
That sort right.
of captures the essence of Gordon Lightfoot and also reminds us that he's been around for a little while.
Oh, yes. And, he's always had a fascination with trains, and that's reflected in a number of his popular songs, and of course, airplanes as well. So to see him standing on the wing of a jetliner at JFK was, I think, is pretty symbolic of just his who he is and what he represents.
Does he have a signature song?
Well, I would say he probably would answer that question himself by saying he has a few, but I think If You Could Read My Mind is probably the one that people call for the most and that people recognize probably more than any other. And I think it's absolutely a quintessential song of lost love or broken love. He wrote it, when his first marriage came to an end. And the imagery in that, about paperback novels and wishing wells and all of that imagery is just so vivid. And he wrote it, out of a very dark episode in his life, but it's funny how that sometimes pays dividends for a songwriter.
Was there a love of his life?
Well, I mean, I think that he's had a number of romances, and, they've all been reflected in his songs. I think women are very important to Gordon Lightfoot, and there's an expression I think that songwriters or poets use about people who are inspirational. They're called the muse, and I think there've been a number of women who have been Gordon Lightfoot's muse, they would be not only the women he's been married to or has lived with, but they're the women that he's had affairs with over the years. I mean, he was, during the 1970s, Jim, he was one of the most desirable men on the planet. He looked like, a Roman god with his blonde curls, and he had the voice to match, just a gorgeous, baritone. So he was very much a magnet, I suppose you might say, during those years through the 1970s.
Is he appreciative of his place in music history?
It's a funny thing with Gordon Lightfoot, Jim, and that's another thing that fascinated me, is for someone with that body of work, with that level of success that he's had, because he has had number one hits million selling records. But he's innately a modest, very humble guy, and it's not false modesty. It's genuine. And I think that comes from, who he is as growing up in a small town as he did. So I don't think he fully gets just how big he is and how important he is to a lot of people. But he certainly has been getting a lot of accolades and awards and lifetime achievement. Recognition and so on. So it probably, on a certain level, is sinking in that he's made a difference. Coming from a small town and really to the top of the charts over the course of his journey.
Nicholas Jennings, congratulations on a fabulous biography, Lightfoot from Viking. It is out and about and available for reading, and it is quite a tour de force about the fabulous Gordon Lightfoot. Thank you, sir.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.